on today's episode of the Law of Tech podcast.
First, and of course as lawyers, that's where you start, you want to identify issues. If there is no issue created by the tech, why would you even care about it, right? It doesn't really make sense. So first you identify the issues, then you may want to identify the positive ramification of a technology, and then you try to see if there is a correlation between the good and the bad. And often you will find that the answer to this is positive. Not necessarily. So if it's not the case, it's easy, right? You get rid of the negative ramifications and you can preserve the good ones. If they are linked, then comes the time to address the trade-offs, right? In any case, I think what it leads to be very practical is to tackle a problem. You always have different solutions. If I go back to Lessig, you may use just the law, you may combine the law and the tech, you may use the norms, the markets, always different solutions. And I think what I would love to see is sometimes for the policymakers and the regulators to say, okay, we considered all of those different solutions, and we think that this one is best at maintaining a balance between preserving the good coming out of the tech and eliminating the bad, the negative ramifications. And then we can discuss, right? But at least this will be a step forward as opposed to just trying to tackle what is bad without even considering the goods. Usually we do say, well, tech could be good, but, and that's it.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Law of Tech podcast. We have arrived at the fourth and final episode of the first sub-series in season 3 of the podcast, which essentially revolves around the shift from the law and technology approach to the law plus technology approach, answering the question whether a new era has started. Now, putting all of this into perspective, or especially the law plus tech approach, from a legal innovation or in a legal innovation context, we will be talking to Dr. Thibaut Schreppel. But before we delve deeper into the topic of this episode, a quick word from our sponsor, BettyBlocks. Are you looking for a way to create solutions that will make legal processes faster, easier, and more efficient? Do you want to offer the best client experience with great digital services? Well, look no further than our sponsor for this episode, BettyBlocks. Rapidly build custom legal tech applications such as legal intake portals, ESG assessments without a single line of code. Start building your own solutions today with BettyBlocks. Now, Thibaut is an associate professor of law at the Vrije University of Amsterdam and a faculty affiliate at Stanford University Codex Center, where he has created the Computational Antitrust Project that brings together over 60 antitrust agencies. Thibaut also holds research and teaching positions in Paris. He is a Harvard University Berkman Center alumnus, a member of the French Superior Audiovisual Council Scientific Board, and a blockchain expert appointed to the World Economic Forum. Thibaut, welcome to the show, and that's a pretty impressive track record.
Yes, thanks very much. I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you very much. And as I just briefly mentioned before we started recording this episode, this sub-series, or the first sub-series of the Law of Tech podcast, season 3, really revolves around the shift from the law and technology approach to the law plus technology approach. And that really formed the basis, or was the topic, of a paper you recently wrote. So I don't think I need to give a whole introduction on the paper, of course, as you are the author of the paper, and no one better to speak to than you. So maybe to kind of get into this topic to start, can you maybe tell us a little bit more about the, you know, the law plus technology approach, the law and technology approach, their origins, and what led you to write this paper?
Sure. So long story short, I published a book 2 years ago now entitled Blockchain Plus Antitrust, in which I was basically making a point that the two, so blockchain and antitrust, were more effective if they were to be combined than to be seen as the usual way, which is a very confrontational way. And the reason why I realized that is because I got interested in blockchain, and as a lawyer, my natural tendency was to write papers explaining all the issues that blockchain could create, right? Because why would you talk about all the situations where everything goes according to the plan? It doesn't make sense as a lawyer, or so I thought at the time. And eventually I realized that, you know, I wanted more blockchain adoption and for the technology to scale. So I combined all those publications into a book and try to make a point that, of course, as lawyers, we have to answer the challenges that a technology will create, but ideally we should do it in a way to also preserve the technology if we think, you know, it may improve the common good. So I published that book, Blockchain Plus Antitrust, that so many times got introduced when I went around to present the book as a blockchain and antitrust book. So it was, you know, perfect segue for me to say, no, it's actually plus. So from that, I then, you know, thought about it, whether or not I could generalize the approach a little bit, and came to the conclusion that indeed it would be possible. And so instead of just specifically focusing on blockchain, I focused here on the technology. And instead of just targeting antitrust or competition law, I went for the legal rules and standards. I can give you examples, but you know, for AI, I think that's a good one. Of course, it comes with lots of challenges when it comes to creating or automating discrimination, but we also know that it can be used to prevent discrimination or reduce the human biases. So that's the reason why I tried to, you know, think about that a little bit more and write a paper that we will discuss.
Very, very interesting. And like you said, you know, technology can kind of form a double-edged, or the mix between technology and law can form kind of a double-edged sword. Like on the one hand, it can create problems for the law, like how should we respond to these new technologies and the potential negative implications they have. While at the same time, technology can also offer solutions to some of the problems that we are currently facing. Now, you just mentioned, I don't want to spoil the topic that we're now going to be discussing, but what was the response to this publication? You mentioned that you got some extreme reactions, both positive and negative. I'm curious. For two reasons. The first one is for those who responded positively. I think that's really nice to hear, and like it's a confirmation of some of the ideas that you had. How do you actually implement the law plus technology approach in practice? Like what can these people do in practice to really implement this law plus tech approach? And at the same time, why are those that were somewhat negative about it skeptical of the idea? Like what is holding them back from realizing the potential of implementing law plus tech rather than law and tech?
Let me explain. So on a very personal level here, for the one that reacted in a negative way, I would say for one part, there is this idea that technology is bad. And in fact, those people will often present themselves as being liberals. And I think they are actually the true conservative. And there is nothing wrong with that, right? But they are under the impression, I disagree, but why not, that technology will put society in a worse place than what it is, than where it is right now. I recently read a book by a professor from the MIT, Elting Morrison, who published in the 60s a book in which he actually explains the way by which every technology that is shifting power is welcomed by the people in the position of power. And I think academics are in a position of power, right? We have the great power, the leisure to research what we want, to influence the policymakers. And Elting is making a point that first, we ignore. Second, we have a tendency to engage in a rational argument, right? So you hear that a lot about blockchain. It cannot scale. It's not super decentralized, you know, although you guys say it's decentralized. And then it comes to the name calling, right? Because it touches something very profound. So I had some of those reactions at the third level, so the name calling, because it goes against the ideology that right, you know, the past is actually better. And some others were trying to engage in a rational argument, and that's great. And I'm grateful for that, and it made the paper, I hope, a bit stronger. So I published the final version just at the beginning of 2023. For the positive reactions, they were on a different level. Some people were very interested in how we could indeed open a voice and potentially another way, which would be not to say that tech is destroying democracy, it's, you know, creating more discrimination. To some degree, those are problems, and I will come back to it. But also not, you know, in some, what we hear sometimes, especially from the lobbyists, that would just say that, you know, there is nothing we should do. Everything will self-regulate and all the problems will be solved eventually. This might be true, But if you need 50 years to solve a problem, I'm not sure that you want to wait for that long. So I got some positive reactions. And to come back to your question, so in practice, what does it mean? I think first, and of course, as lawyers, that's where you start, you want to identify issues. If there is no issue created by a tech, why would you even care about it, right? It doesn't really make sense. So first you identify the issues, then, and that's something that I rarely see, you may want to identify the positive ramification of a technology. If we talk about blockchain, what's good about it is that it may get rid of leveraging strategies, that it may create data commons, data trust, help with data sharing, all the things we've been cherishing for a long time. And then you try to see if there is a correlation between the good and the bad. And often you will find that the answer to this is positive. Not necessarily. So if it's not the case, it's easy, right? You get rid of the negative ramifications and you can preserve the good ones. If they are linked, then comes the time to address my favorite word, that is the one of trade-offs, right? So you have to choose to, on the scale, whether or not you want to get rid of all the negative ramifications entirely, but then you may destroy a bit of the good ones or not. In any case, I think what it leads to be very practical is to tackle a problem. You always have different solutions. If I go back to Lessig, you may use just the law, you may combine the law and the tech, you may use the norms, the markets, always different solutions. And I think what I would love to see is sometimes for the policymakers and the regulators to say, okay, we considered all of those different solutions, and we think that this one is best at maintaining a balance between preserving the good coming out of the tech and eliminating the bad, the negative ramifications. And then we can discuss, right? But at least this will be a step forward as opposed to just trying to tackle what is bad without even considering the goods. Usually we do say, well, tech could be good, but, and that's it. We don't study the correlation between the good and the bad. And that's what's missing. And, you know, I got that from complexity theory. So I'm not the one who came up with the idea. It's actually something that in many fields, biology, economics, physics, is being used on a very regular basis and is very common and not heterodox at all. But somehow for the legal space, I have no idea why, but we don't engage with this kind of approach.
So what is this complexity theory that you're talking about? I indeed read this in the paper. Can you maybe explain a little bit more about this complexity theory and then what the or what its relationship is to this law plus technology approach? You already briefly touched upon it, but maybe if we have a better understanding of what complexity theory exactly is,
we can better understand. Of course. It kind of emerged, the terms complexity theory, and Brian Archer, one of the economists who coined the term complexity economics. So it's a field to which you can apply complexity theory, kind of publicly said that he regretted that because it gives the impression that it's complicated and that you can't understand it, right? So, and it's not at all what this is all about. So something that is complicated is something that you can't compute with your brain or any tools, right? So you will not understand. Complexity theory is slightly different, although it could get to and lead to complications. But complexity theory, the idea is that you study how systems react to the context they create. Or to put it differently, you study what is being called complex adaptive systems. A good example would be, I was listening yesterday to a podcast about how trees interact in a forest, right? Mm-hmm. So what you see is that there are actually very simple relationships between the trees. So usually we assume that they compete. Well, in fact, they will also cooperate, something I've learned quite recently. And those very simple interactions will actually lead to a change in the environment here being the entire forest. It will impact the animals. It will impact the other species that you will see, the other plants. And because the forest is moving in a direction, it actually impacts the trees back, right? And they have to keep on evolving in a different way and adapt. So it's really the relationship between the agent and their environment. Now, if you apply that to digital law, and that leads me to law plus tech, I think complexity theory is helpful at least on three different levels. The first is to understand a problem. So is the problem coming because of the agents, because the way they interact, or because of the environment, right? So first, that's usually something we tend not to address, and we try or tend usually to regulate certain agents. but it might be that the environment is more problematic. Two, once you have identified your problem, you may want to use complexity theory to come up with a good remedy and a good design to address the problem. And here it you can especially do that if you consider whether or not the problem is, and this is something used in complexity theory, robust or fragile. If it's robust, it means that you could try to change certain variables. The problem will or the ecosystem will keep on surviving in the exact same terms, right? Mm-hmm. So, and sometimes it's good. The human body is quite robust, right? We get diseases and most of the time, well, we come back to the normal state of being in good health. But if a problem is robust, and I will argue that the dark web is a good example of that, you get rid of it, you take a website down, and then it reappears, right? So the problem keeps on repeating itself. Yeah. But it could also be that a problem is fragile or an ecosystem is fragile, in which case it means that if you change the slightest element, you would change the nature of the ecosystem potentially forever. And I think this is exactly what we have today with the metaverse. If you are to regulate decentralized blockchains, if you are to change the business model to constrain it, you may change the metaverse for the better or for the worse. So when you intervene, you have to be more careful. The third level is the one of once you design a solution, using complexity theory, you may have the tools to make it adaptive, as opposed to something that is very trending, especially in the legal sphere, the concept of a future-proof regulation. So usually by future-proof, people have in mind that you take a regulation that is so good and so well-informed that it will, in the same terms, keep on being valid and relevant in years from now, right? Mm-hmm. I would argue that if you take the approach of complexity theory, future-proof regulation is by default impossible because if the environment changes, chances are that at some point it won't make sense anymore and you will have to adapt your regulation. But if you make it adaptive, then it means that your regulation will take information about the effect of that precise regulation and adapt and changes over time. One example would be regulating speed on the highway. If you want to make it future-proof, you could say, well, you know what? We're going to make it 70 kilometers. That's how it is. And if we still have that in 20 years, you could say, well, this was future-proof, right? Regardless of the cars, regardless of all the technical development, it's still 70 kilometers, very future-proof. I think mm-hmm. it's not what we want. We may want something more adaptive, which is, well, depending on the quality of the road, depending on the weather, depending on how many cars there is on a certain portion of a highway, the speed will change. And if you can learn about how regulating speed is affecting the agents, maybe less traffic jams, maybe less accidents, then over time, it will make that adaptive regulation better and will vary, you know, potentially very little, maybe just a certain time of the day, but it will actually lead to better understanding the new agents, the new environment, and better regulating it. So that's the promise, at least, of complexity science applied to digital laws.
I'm curious, just linking to like the last point that you mentioned, you're talking about future-proof regulation and that maybe saying like the 70 kilometers isn't quite future-proof, but we should make it, you know, more adaptive to the circumstances of a specific case. Where does the topic of legal certainty come into this? Because I can imagine that, you know, by making a regulation, what it seems, at least that's my interpretation right now, a little more vague, you also risk, you know, compromising legal certainty. So how does that play a role here?
It can be, but not necessarily. So if you consider that making the regulation adaptive, let's go back to the example of the highway, is something that is publicly announced and available. You could say that agents are certain that this piece of regulation will adapt over time, right? Yes. So you have less certainty in a sense because you can't simply, you know, look at the usual sign on the highway that would say 70. You will have to look at signs that would be, you know, displaying a digital information. So that would change. It could be 72. This could be 67 because too many cars and it's a rainy day. But as an agent, if you are aware that the regulation might change, this is you will achieve that objective of, you know, of certainty. We could discuss that for a very long time because I think as lawyers, we are just taught and trained to always favor legal certainty. And I certainly understand why. And there are economic works actually proving that it might be better to stick with a bad regulation than to try to change it regularly to come up with a good one. I'm here referring to the work of Edmund Felth, who is a Nobel Prize laureate on time consistency. I think he published that quite a few years ago. But you may want also sometimes to discuss whether or not we want certainty. I come from the field of competition law. You can make a point that actually uncertainty is the DNA of what is competition, right? You are uncertain about what's going to happen next. And because of uncertainty, you are trying to better innovate, to go faster. So can we also create some uncertainty using the law in competition? This is certainly what you may want to achieve. So, you know, it's one of those concepts we tend not to ever challenge. And if you were to write a master thesis saying that legal certainty is crap, I think you probably will score a very bad grade. But do we want to think about it? Is that, you know, can we actually think about that? I would say yes, and we should actually. So good one. Good subject.
Yeah, for any master thesis students listening. Now, you mentioned like this balancing act, right, between the positive implications of technology and the negative ramifications, and that we kind of have to balance them against each other and then decide, or policymakers and then should decide, you know, how do we address this? You call this in your paper the EM ratio, if I'm not mistaken. I'm just curious to know, how do you really measure like the positive ramifications, the positive implications, negative ramifications? Like, how do you get a concrete answer out of this EM ratio?
So potentially you can't. So it's more of a way of thinking than to be able to use math and algebra. What we tend to do, especially, you know, in the field of law and econ, but now it's also applied to privacy and IP, is that we do cost-benefit analysis. Yeah. I like the idea very much, right? You take the good, the bad. But it kind of implies that you can rationalize everything. And once you have rationalized everything, you can make a list, the good, the bad, and then you can make a decision based on that list, right? The problem, and I'm sure we've all tried that, you know, in our personal life, you make a list, should I do this, should I not? The problem is that it's hard to weigh in and to say, well, this factor in the good or bad column has more weight for me. And what's also hard is that once you take a decision upon the list, so you decide to go somewhere, to marry someone, to, you know, have a child based on your list, it might be that you are changed as a human being, and therefore actually you will look at the list and it wouldn't make sense anymore. So I have issues with the cost benefits approach. I understand why it's better than not to have anything at all. But I think he relies too much on this idea of, you know, perfect rationality and perfect information in the hand of the person making a decision. What I have in mind with the EM ratio is more of a way of thinking and approaching problems. So what you would do is that, again, you would try to, and by definition, it's impossible to predict all the good uses you will make of a tech. Yeah. If I want to give you an example, when electricity was invented, you could probably foresee at the time that it would be convenient to get rid of the candles and to have, you know, better lighting in the living room, but certainly not that the electric guitar would be invented, right? And I mean, if you consider electric guitar to be good, well, you see how you can't just predict the future and all the good uses coming out of the tech. Same for the bad ones. But still, what you may want here is to try to study how, if you think a technology may create some good, it might be, I don't have any example in mind, that a tech is pure evil, right? It will never create anything good, in which case, get rid of it, easy. But if you think a technology may create some good, and this might be true for pretty much all of them, you may want to consider how to ensure survival of that technology. And what we know from the work of Darwin and the evolutionist is that usually the reason why you can survive over time and the way by which there is a natural selection process is that you can actually utilize your unique features in your environment. A very common example would be, okay, you are a bird and the only bird in town. Well, you can probably fly and then, you know, pick up the fruits up in the tree. And if I cut those wings, then suddenly you are, I guess, a bird with no wings. So you can't not only get the food up there, but if there is a lion, well, you'll be killed because the lion can run faster than you do. So it's more of a way to say, okay, let's connect the good and the bad. Let's ensure that a technology is actually in a position to survive over time. Because if you look at most of the tech you may have in mind, so quantum computers, 3D printing, blockchain, AI, usually the way by which they can improve the common good is by utilizing those unique features. So you know for a fact that if you get rid of those, the technology is gone. And yes, you may have addressed the problem, but you can also for sure be in a position and being able to say that you will get rid of the good that was created by the tech. Two concrete examples. One is smart contracts. If you've never inquired smart contract, it's basically a potential transaction put on top of a blockchain. So set to be immutable, right? So once you record a transaction, such as if it rains tomorrow in Leiden, Netherlands, I give you a Bitcoin. Once it's there, it will stay. If you are to get rid of that immutability feature, I understand why it's convenient from a legal perspective, because if you change your mind, you can actually get rid of it. But the reason why people use smart contracts in the first place is precisely because they are immutable and it creates trust. You know, once the smart contract is recorded, it will happen. So I had the chance to write a report to the European Commission precisely to explain this point. Another one is unsupervised machine learning. Sure, you can make a point that it could be problematic. Why? Because you give the entry but not the exit. So you have no idea how the system will behave, the way the system will cluster information. But that's also the beauty of it, right? It means that you can actually achieve a result that you can think about designing with your human brain. So if you get rid or prohibit unsupervised machine learning, and there are papers out there saying that we should, what you know for sure is that you also get rid of all of the creativity coming out of those systems. Again, it's more of a mental model than something that you will quantify.
A calculation. You just mentioned that you wrote a report to the European Commission, and that was specifically on the smart contracts. Now, looking at like the European level, we see some developments in regulation, for instance, the AI Act, which I thought maybe it'd be interesting to touch upon, because there you kind of see like this risk-based approach, right? Where on the one hand, the regulators are saying like, okay, these certain technologies we do not want at all because these cause harms that we absolutely do not want. At the same time, well, it's a leveled regulation. So then for the still harmful technologies that we do not want to exclude completely, there are some further requirements, obviously, and it goes down and down. Is this what you envision when you're talking about like this balancing act where we need to leave room for innovation while at the same time addressing some of the harmful impacts? Or do you think that we still need a different approach, or the European Union, the Commission should take a somewhat other approach?
Yeah, so I had a chance to discuss that, and the video is out there with the rapporteur in charge of the act before the European Parliament. And the point I was making is that I think it goes in the right direction, right? Instead of just saying we regulate AI, whatever it means. But it might be that it's not granular enough. Let me explain why. What we have right now is that the European Commission will tell you, okay, we look at, okay, we exclude certain use cases. So face recognition, whatever. So let's not discuss about that. It's just purely excluded. For the high-risk one, what we say is that if you operate that AI system in what the European Commission considers to be a high-risk sector, such as health or education could be one, or you know, it could be to drive this car, then if you use an AI system, you have to comply with certain requirements. And if you, however, uses the exact same technology in a sector that we consider to be non-risky or low risk, then there are certain requirements, but it's much, much lower. It kind of makes sense, but I think to some degree we can do better, and here's why and how. The way by which the AI function, as I just mentioned in my previous answer, I think is very important. If I use a expert system, so a bunch of, you know, predefined rules, if then that, I know precisely where the AI system will end up, right? I can, and it's very easy for me to verify. It seems to me that it's less risky to use such an expert system in health than to use a unsupervised machine learning system in which you have no idea of what the output could be in a sector that is considered to be non-risky, such as, you know, a chatbot on a website. Because what if the chatbot goes crazy and starts, you know, calling you names and, you know, making racist comments? This might not be a nice experience, right? Especially for certain groups of people. So what I would like to see here is that I understand why the sectorial approach is good and, you know, it goes in the right direction. Health is risky. I understand that. But we may want to complement it with also more of a technical approach in which we say, okay, you know what? The heaviest burden when it comes to those requirements will be imposed only where the AI system operates in a risky sector plus uses a creative AI where you don't control the output. And there, indeed, you can make a point that, you know, it goes in a law plus technology approach in which you try, generally speaking, to preserve the ability for startup and companies to use the tech to improve the common good where the law is not self-sufficient, whilst addressing the stressing issues that we have in the space. But as it stands, it also creates an incentive if you are in health, not to use AI at all, because it does not discriminate depending on the type of AI system, which I think, again, is something we should do in this regulation.
So more based on the technology that is used rather than the sector in which it is applied.
Or combine the two. Yeah. Or you may want to combine the two. Yeah. I think what we will see is that the definition of what is AI will change because as it stands, it's way too broad and it seems that there is a consensus emerging around this very specific issue. The first draft of the AI Act basically covers every software operating in Europe. And they say that to comply with the AI Act, it will be, I forgot the exact numbers, but something like 5 to 10K. And I think this isn't true and they are aware of it. You know, the lawyers with expertise, so a bit of the technical expertise plus a great legal expertise will probably charge for the best 500 euro an hour to 1K an hour. And I doubt that they will actually make your system compliant in just 5 hours of work, right? So it will be very costly. And same as GDPR, we now have the numbers. It was actually proportionally costlier for the small companies to comply with GDPR than the big ones. And this is not what we want, right? We want more competition. So the definition of what is AI, I suspect, will change. I understand why machine learning and especially if it, you know, trains with deep learning should be there. But for the expert systems, the decision trees, whatever statistical analysis means, I will exclude that from the AI Act. That will be, you know, going in the right direction. So this is feasible. Yeah.
Looking at the topic of the other episodes that we had before this episode, we're talking about legal innovation. So until now, we've really been talking about the interaction between law and tech. And what I mean by legal innovation, I'm talking about using technology to innovate the legal space, the way we practice law. That's what we've been talking about in the past episodes also. And it's interesting because when you were describing the complexity theory, you were really talking about, you know, identifying a problem, then moving to the solution, and finally also implementation of that. And that's also what we've discussed, for instance, in the first episode, which was how do you fall in love with a problem space rather than directly going towards solutions. Now, looking at this law plus tech approach, how do you kind of see this best being implemented when we talk about legal practice, like innovating in the legal space? Do you have like a thought on that?
Yeah, so it's more of a working hypothesis. So far, it seems, at least in my work, to be confirmed, but you will find many exceptions to what I'm about to say. It seems to me that, generally speaking, one way to implement the law plus technology approach, which is, again, you combine the two so that you better... So basically that you will better address the limitations of the law. And some, you know, many times we don't detect infringements. It's hard to come up with effective regulations. On the side of the technology, many times you will need the law because, you know, you can't just code everything in advance. And it seems to me that if you really want to combine those two and make them work together, one way to address the issues is to actually rely on the technology. Why? Because first, if you do that, it means that those two groups, the lawyers and the techies, they have to work together. And this can't hurt, right? It means you get to better understand what are the objectives, the way of thinking. It's very different. Two, because technology is granular, as we, you know, discuss with the highway regulation, it could be that you will code many conditions. You could also, of course, use machine learning and come up with a piece of regulation that is dynamic and very, very effective because granular and, you know, adapted to the environment. And so it seems to me that what you may want to consider are what I call the law plus code. So that's one way to be very concrete and implement and go toward the law plus tech. And there you really have two categories. One that will be code as law. So what you do here is that you use the power of code and the fact that indeed it constrains behavior in a way to make people comply. So whether you want to force them very coercive, kind of paternalistic, or maybe you want to nudge them in this direction. A good example was the one of the DRM in the MP3, right? Or if you are a subscriber to Apple Music, you know you can download the M4A on your computer, but if you are to send it to a friend, that friend can't play it on her or his computer, right? So it's a good example of a code as law approach. Twitter, to some degree, is implementing that. So if you are trying to retweet a tweet with a URL, and if you haven't clicked on the URL before trying to retweet that, it will actually ask you, are you sure you don't want to read it first, right? So it's less coercive and it's kind of a code as law. Law as code, what you do here is that you approach the law in a way that can be consumed by a computer. And the objective is to better understand the law, better draft the law, and potentially, you know, better eventually enforce it. So it leads to using natural language processing, network analysis. I think it's a very powerful tool where you will actually put decisions or citations or doctrinal publications in kind of a network. And that visualization, if done properly, could actually, you know, give you some perspective on the meta information that is not visible to the human brain. And so on and so forth. There are many of those law as code solutions. And on average, I think they score well in, again, being very granular and effective, which is the objective that you may want to achieve with law plus tech. Because again, if you get rid of the tech, there is no law plus tech approach possible at all, because you got rid of one of the two pillars.
I'm curious, because you said, you know, by law and tech working together, so lawyers and techies working together, they can learn from each other. And we also discussed already in the beginning, you know, the role of policymakers in making laws that will fit to the landscape, balancing law and tech. How do we get these people to speak the same language? And then I'm specifically asking this question because you obviously also are a professor, and you, I'm assuming, also like interact with students. So that's also always a topic that, you know, is very popular. It's like a very popular debate now. How do we prepare law students, for instance? But also, how do we prepare lawyers? How do we prepare policymakers? So in your opinion, maybe two questions, actually, how do we get these people to speak the same language? And secondly, do you have any resources or any tips and tricks, like, for people listening to, you know, start this, this process?
Yeah, sure. So indeed, I feel very privileged to be able to interact with so many students here in the Netherlands, in France, in the United States. I actually teach a course entitled Law Plus Technology here in the Netherlands at the VU Amsterdam at the law school. So here what we do is that I teach them what is computational thinking, what is complexity theory, how to approach, not to transform those law students into computer scientists, because they don't want to be computer scientists. That's why they went to law school and not to the School of Computer Science, but to put them in a position to be able to work with computer scientists, right? So not to be a dinosaur. I also teach to computer scientists, or at least to students in the space. And here we teach a course on the AI Act, where I ask them actually to take the AI Act, and we go, you know, through several articles, and I ask them, okay, from a technical perspective, how do you improve that? What are the technical limitations that you see? And I would say that the willingness of both groups, the law and the computer scientists, to learn is actually quite high. And this came as a surprise, because I was previously teaching in a master program dedicated to law and economics. And we had issues when the student, you know, comes the time for you to teach about econometrics, will actually complain and would say, you know, I didn't go to law school to learn about the math and the formula. Well, this was necessary. I was kind of expecting the same. So when I teach the basic of coding, I was kind of expecting that some of those law students will complain and say, you know, I didn't go to law school to learn about that. But actually, almost 100% of them are very excited. And same for the computer scientist, right? Because, I mean, it depends on how you put it. But the way by which we teach the AI Act, we say, well, first, you have no choice. It will apply to everything you design. You don't want to be in a situation where you design something and you are told, well, no, it can't work because it's contrary to the law. It's no. not a pleasant feeling. And if you actually understand the law, it will actually, it could make you, you know, super powerful because you have the technical expertise plus a legal background. So there is a natural tendency to be willing to work with the other group, which is not something, I mean, I was surprised because I didn't hear that before. When it comes to the more of the academic side, I introduced the Law Plus Technology Circle back in January of 2023. Just, you know, a Google form saying if you are an academic and you are interested in those, so it could be complexity science, it could be the use of tech to better enact the law, so computational law, and so on and so forth, please sign in. And the group is now with representatives from pretty much all over the world, right? With dozens and dozens of academics. So again, there is a willingness, and I think we need to better coordinate. But if you want to get started, I would say don't be afraid. To some degree, you don't understand how a smartphone works, and actually no one in the entire world could design a smartphone from scratch. Actually, you know, there is a very famous example that no one in the entire world could design a pen from scratch, right? Because it will require so many skills that are divided and spread all across the world that it's impossible for any single human being to do that. Same for the smartphone, right? Certainly. So what I mean by that is that although you have no idea how to design a smartphone, as a lawyer, you certainly understand, if you are interested in that, all the implications that smartphones may have on the law, on societies, what we may need to do as a lawyer. The same is true for AI and blockchain. You are not required to learn how to code a blockchain from scratch, how to design unsupervised machine learning with the deep learning, you know, behind and regressions. It's great if you are interested in that, but you have simply to reach the level where you kind of can have a dialogue with those people with the technical expertise. And for that, there are many tools. And in fact, if you go to the networklawreview.org and there is a search box and you enter resources in computer science, I've listed all the resources that you can use to learn about computer science from scratch. Everything is open source. I will mention CS50. It's a free course that you can take at Harvard University. Absolutely fantastic. Especially there is one, CS50L, designed for lawyers. But there are more that you may want to explore. And if you are more, you know, into podcasts, and I suppose if you are listening to this one, this might be the case. I also listed a list of tech podcasts. So purely tech, right? So no legal discussions, but tech podcasts that are relevant and accessible to social scientists. So have a look at that. I try my best to make everything open source, so nothing here, no credit card required, and a lot of fun, I suppose, in front of you.
Yes, definitely. Now, I will wrap up the episode here, but just to end, thank you so much for the discussion.
All right.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the Law of Tech podcast. If you want to make sure you keep up to date with the show and never miss out on an episode, be sure to subscribe on your podcast platform of choice and follow the Law of Tech on social media. If you enjoyed the show, please give it a rating or review as it helps others discover the show. And don't forget to share it with your network. For now, have a great day, and I'll see you in the next episode of the Law of Tech podcast. Yeah.